I managed to prepare quite a lot of material for this lecture, but after realizing that it won't be simply possible to cover in 1 hour and 15 minutes, I have decided to cut what I have written almost in half and talk about probably the most interesting and the most important thing from the perspective of modern condensed matter physics, namely tightly bound electrons. Why this topic is important and why the Hamiltonians that are involved in description of tightly bound electrons are so important. The reason is that the majority of low dimensional systems are described exactly by the Hamiltonians that involve hopping of electrons between the lattice sites. As I mentioned some time ago, people no longer consider Schrödinger equation with coordinate wave functions. Instead, they write down the electron, the Hamiltonians in the occupation number representations and assume that there, that free electrons, their spectrum have a specific dispersion that is determined upon comparison with experimental data. So I will talk about tightly bound electrons and tight binding band on the lattice. So tightly bound electrons, what is meant here by tight binding? When we have an electron that is located quite close to its host atom, then we call it tightly bound electron. So if we have a nuclei and we have some electron on the outer shell, that this is electron, that this is nuclei, then, I'm sorry, I was not able to clean some portions of the board well enough. So it requires a lot of efforts, unfortunately, to clean this board. Okay, so then if we have another nuclei and another electron located quite close to it, then we can imagine a crystal in which the probability of finding this electron far from the nuclei is very small. And if we have another nuclei that is quite far away from this nuclei, then the probability of finding this electron here is quite small. And we can imagine that we're building a crystal by considering all such systems and bringing them closer. So we can imagine the third nuclei and the electron located very close to it. Again, this electron with highest probability can be located close to its host nuclei. And the probability to find it close to the other nuclei is very small. This is what is meant schematically by tightly bound electrons. So electrons are still can be considered moving in the form of a Bloch wave throughout the crystal. But the highest probability for each electron to be found is near one particular nuclei. So the process in which, say, this electron is found nevertheless with some small probability near the other nuclei is called hopping. It's called hopping. So since the probability of hopping is quite small, then the terms in the Hamiltonian that describe hopping, as I will talk towards the end of the lecture, are quite small in terms of energy. So this is the schematic form of a crystal that is built from tightly bound electrons, from the electrons that are very close to the nuclei. So let's consider a one-dimensional system. One-dimensional system, it is just a chain of atoms. And with period A, and write down the Schrödinger equation that describes the motion of an electron in the potential created by nuclei. The Schrödinger equation will be minus h bar squared divided by 2m, d2 psi over dx squared, plus the potential created by nuclei. And we will write this potential in the following form. Sum over all sides n, here n, n small labels the sides, so that x coordinate is equal to n a. I will write the vector r that describes the coordinates of ions, while x is continuous variable, is the standard coordinate. So the sum over all sides n, and I write the potential in this form, v as a function of x minus a, times psi of x equal to epsilon. I will denote the energy as epsilon psi of x. So this is, in fact, our original potential u of x that was written down when we proved the Bloch's theorem of the previous lecture. The question is, can you write the potential in this form? The answer is yes. Yes, but only when the potentials created by single ions decay fast enough. So we imply that when we sum over n, the corresponding sum converges. Obviously, long-range potentials such as Coulomb potential is not a good candidate, but a good candidate will be a potential that decays, say, exponentially. Whether this is a reasonable approximation valid in reality, the answer is yes. Why? Because, of course, when I wrote down this picture, I depicted only one electron, but there are many electrons that in fact screen the Coulomb potential of the positively charged bare nuclei. So one can imagine that V of X decays very fast, fast already at distances greater than A. So in fact, if the potential is created by this ion, then here it is almost exponentially small compared to its values just here. In this case, we can write our original potential U of X in this way. Then, one more very simplifying assumption. We know the solution of the Schrödinger equation that describes the motion of electron around one single nuclei. So we can write minus d2 phi over dx squared times h bar squared divided by 2m, of course, plus V of x phi equal to epsilon naught phi. So phi of x, the wave function of an electron near a nuclei. Near one given nucleus. And epsilon naught is the energy level. Of course, this Schrödinger equation has many eigenvalues, and there are many energy levels. But we decide to choose only one energy level and ask a question: what happens to this single energy level in the presence of all other nuclei that form the crystal structure? What will happen to this epsilon naught? I will show that the answer is one single energy level broadens into a very narrow band due to the fact that the electron that is initially located closer to this nuclei can hop, say, into location around the neighboring nucleus. So the wave function also decays fast enough. So if this is phi of x, then the wave function also decays exponentially, and the characteristic distance of decay is also the period of the lattice A. So we need to solve the following equation: minus 8 bar squared divided by 2m d2 psi over dx squared plus nv x minus na times psi of x equal to epsilon psi of x. Having this Schrödinger equation that describes the motion of a single electron around one nucleus. The question is how to proceed and which approximations should we choose. The starting point is the following. We know that because this periodic is potential, and this can be seen from that definition, obviously, we can say that function psi of x are the Bloch's functions. They must be. We don't have any other choice. Psi of x are the Bloch's functions. And they can be rewritten in the following form: psi k of x equal to I in power I kx u k of x, where u k of x is a periodic function. U k of x equal to u k as a function of x plus a. There is no band index. The reason for this is that upon solution to this problem, we will have just only one band. No band index. Yes?
Is the no band index, since we're dealing with focusing on just one band, is that the assumption you mentioned?
So, at this point, exactly, very good question. This is an assumption that needs to be verified a posteriori. The reason is that the other bands are located very, very far up in terms of energy. So within the approximation, we will adopt. But strictly speaking, the other bands will be present as well. But they are separated from the lowest band by very, very high energies. And typically, in the tight binding description, the other possible bands are simply omitted. So no bad index at this point. K belongs to the first Brillouin zone as usual. K varies from minus pi over A to pi over A. The whole point is that solving this Schrödinger equation written this way, using these functions, is not a very convenient thing. Instead of the block functions written in the more conventional way, we will choose the other functions, the so-called Vanier functions. Vanier functions, named after very famous Vanier. Yeah, after very famous physicist Gregory Hugh Vanier, whose name you will probably see in other courses, especially in statistical physics course. So the so-called Kramers-Vanier theorem that is relevant to the two-dimensional Ising model and where else, and probably in subsequent condensed matter courses. So Vanier functions. These are the linear combinations of these more conventional block functions. We will write them in the following way. Omega n of x equal to 1 over square root of n, sum over all k belonging to the Brillouin zone. So again, we formally consider the system finite, chain of length L, and can formally regard k discrete. E in power minus I k n a times psi k of x. I deliberately used the chalk of different color. So this is just the definition of Vanier functions. And we will be using these functions to solve the Schrödinger equation. But first of all, let me talk about the properties of Vanier functions that are quite interesting. Some properties of Vanier functions. Property one. We can invert this definition and express psi of k via Vanier functions. The normalizing factor 1 square root of n. This normalizing factor is very convenient when we take explicitly the description of the original lattice. So n is the total number of sides in our chain. So 1 over square root of n, then sum over all n's. N is the index denoting the sides of the lattice. E in power I k n a omega n as function of x. So the consistency of both definitions can be checked with the help of the following important relation that you're invited to check. Checked using the following relation, that if we sum over all n e in power I k minus k prime n a equal to n delta k, comma k prime. If we sum over all n this, then we will get n times the Kronecker delta of k, comma k prime. So using this relation, it is easy to verify that these definitions are consistent. Then, so property two, when your functions form orthonormal bases, namely, if we integrate over the whole volume, basically over the whole space occupied by the chain, then we will have Wn of x, so Wn star, because we take the Copley's conjugate, times omega m of x dx equal to delta m. This property can be also checked if we take into account that Bloch's functions themselves form orthonormal bases. So psi car star of x times psi car prime of x integrated over the whole volume is equal to delta k k prime. I probably didn't have time to mention that Bloch's functions indeed form orthonormal bases with respect to quasi-momentum k from the first Brillouin zone and with respect to the band index. But because they are periodic, sometimes people use the normalization condition with when the integral is taken over the primitive cell rather than the whole volume. So here it is more convenient to adopt this renormalization condition. So of course, normalization conditions are consistent because L is equal to n large times A. But let's assume that Bloch's functions are normalized this way. So using this condition, one can also prove that the Vanier functions themselves form orthonormal bases expressed via this relation. And finally, one more and very important property of Vanier functions. Wn of x is not very close to zero. To zero only near one specific site, namely near x equal to nA. So this follows from the definition if we substitute the Bloch's wave function into this definition. Follows from omega n of x equal to 1 over square root of n, sum over k, E k, e in power I k, times x minus n a, u k of x. Look at this expression. U k of x is typically a very smooth function, and k's are located very densely, because they are 2 pi over L times some integer, right? So if x is not very close to NA, then this term has a considerable oscillatory character. And when we sum over all k, we get almost zero. Of course, this is not a rigorous proof, but believe me, this is true. If you say, put here uk equal to 1, but in general, it's a function of the order of 1, but very, very, very smooth. This is what typically occurs. So there is no reason for uk to have any peaks or singularity, because uk plays the role of the function that modulates the regular wave. So if you set uk equal to 1, you will get exactly delta function, delta of x minus na, meaning that Vanier function has the delta functional peak at x equal to na. Of course, uk of x, not exactly equal to 1, but very close to 1, of course, broadens this potential delta function, but does not change this conclusion. So this property, I will label it as a property 3, is a very important property, and will essentially play the key role when we substitute the Vanier functions, or better to say, Bloch functions expressed through Vanier functions into our Schrödinger equation. So let's substitute psi k of x in this form into our Schrödinger equation. It's very good that I have. So substitute. Into our Schrödinger equation written above. And get the following. Sum over all n minus a bar squared divided by 2m d squared over dx squared plus. And I will write all the terms in the following form. And then comment on them. Vx minus na e in power I k n a omega n of x plus sum over all n here u of x, where u of x is our original potential, so given by that formula on the top, minus vx minus na e in power I k n a omega n of x, and this is equal to epsilon potentially, of course, is a function of k, times the sum over n e I k n n omega n of x. So in fact, if you can look at these two terms, then I simply did the following. I added v of x minus na and subtracted it. So this term cancel each other, but it is convenient to write using this form and denote what stands there in this bracket as h of x, denote this temporarily, h of x. So, and we notice the following property. We notice the following property. When we consider u of x minus v x minus na, then this h of x will not contain the term with n. Why? Because this term is artificially subtracted from the original potential. This is very, very important. Why? Because let's recall property number 3, that w n of x is sharply peaked near x equal to na. And this term is absent when x is equal to na. So this term is not sharply peaked when a is, when x is equal to na. So we can regard this term, this whole second term in our equations, formally small. Formally small, and consider this whole term in the Schrodinger equation as a perturbation. Formally small, hence considered as a perturbation. As a perturbation. So any questions at that point? Yes, Nicole.
Could you explain again why at x equals n, h
of
x doesn't exist?
So because u of x minus v x minus na is equal to u of x. We use the definition of u of x. Sum over m v x minus m a over all m minus v x minus n a. So in this sum, if m is equal to n, then the corresponding term when m is equal to n simply disappears. So in other words, we can write it as follows: as the sum over all m not equal to n of v x minus m a. It is very essential because this term creates additional smallness. Additional smallness. So this term contains Wn that is sharply peaked around Na. This term also contains Wn that is peaked around x equal to Na. And this term contains something small standing before omega n. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's only small in the region around x equals n a, right?
It is, yes. But around all other regions, it is not small, but this is small. You see the point? It's not a rigorous proof, but it's a very beautiful argument. So in this term, if potential is not small, then the Vanier function is small. And vice versa, where Vanier function omega, sorry, not omega, but Wn is not small, then the potential is small. So everywhere, this term is small. So, and hence, we can try to organize a perturbation theory in such a way that this term is treated as a perturbation. So in the lowest approximation. Okay, very, very good. So in the lowest approximation, we have the following. If we drop this small term and try to seek the solution in the following form, omega nx is equal to omega nx in the zero approximation plus omega n 1 of x, and so forth. And the same for energies. Epsilon as a function of k equal to epsilon 0 approximation as a function of k. We will see that epsilon in the 0 approximation won't depend on k and will be given just by that epsilon naught in a second, plus the higher approximation, epsilon the first approximation is a function of k plus multi dots. So when we substitute the zeroth approximation, we will have the following equation. That sum of n minus h bar squared divided by 2m d 2 over dx squared plus v x minus n a e I k n a omega n x equal to epsilon here zeroth approximation zero k sum over n e in power I k n a omega n zero of x. So all omega n as functions of x form orthonormal bases, so they are independent. So this means that for each n, we can solve the Schrödinger equation separately. But let's compare this equation with the equation written on the very top. When we compare, we will be convinced that epsilon at the zero order is equal to simply epsilon naught, namely the energy level for the Schrödinger equation describing the motion of an electron around just one single nucleus. While the Vanier function in the zero approximation is just the corresponding wave functions only around the point x equal to na. As expected, of course, here x. As expected, this function phi decays very, very quickly if moved away from point na. It is in complete agreement with property 3 of Vanier functions. Now, what happens if we go to the next order? Because, because the equation of the next order is a little bit cumbersome, so I will use this door. I will use this board and erase what is written there. So going to the next approximation, we can derive the following equation. Well, it's just very easy to do the algebra, only the result is a little bit lengthy. Minus h bar divided by tmd over dx squared plus vx minus na. Minus epsilon naught omega n in the first approximation is a function of x, e in power I k n a equal to epsilon. Well, this is the exact epsilon minus epsilon naught. This is basically epsilon 1 of k that you see here. We decided simply to write it in this way, here 0. Sum over n e in power I k n a phi x minus n a minus sum over n h of x e in power I k n a phi x minus n a. Right, so this is our left-hand side, and this is our right-hand side. And we need to determine what stands here, this epsilon, the first approximation. What are we going to do? I should tell you that, of course, strictly speaking, h depends on n as well, because in this h, potential around the n side is included, so it's better to put hn as well. I'm sorry, it's a significant thing. I will put index n here. This just means that hn does not contain the contribution from the nth side to the potential. Very, very good. The question is how to determine what stands here. And the trick is similar to how people determine the corrections to the energy spectrum in the standard perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. We do the following. We multiply both sides by phi star. Well, I put phi star as function of x. I put the complex conjugate, but strictly speaking, those phis that describe the motion of an electron around the atom can be chosen real. But anyway, multiply by psi star of x and integrate over the whole volume. See, I will say, I use the index L or V, over the coordinates in the space of the chain, integrate over dx. So as a result of this, let's look at the left-hand side, what we have at the left-hand side. And here it's a good idea to write in some more detail. So left-hand side of, I will put star here, of star, is equal to the following. So we integrate dx, phi star of x, sum over n minus algebra squared divided by 2m d 2 over dx squared plus v x minus n a minus epsilon naught, right? Omega 1, omega, sorry, not omega, well, the WN. I quite often confuse these letters because they are written similarly. So WN of X, E in power I can K, K N A, DX. This is just the restatement of what I have just said. Now we will use the following thing. This second derivative operator acts on Wn. We flip this second derivative in such a way as a result of integration by part that it will act on this phi star. So after doing this, we will get the following result equal to dx Wn1 of x in front, then sum over n minus h bar squared divided by 2m d2 dx squared minus epsilon naught plus vx minus an a. And here we have phi star of x, e I k n a, dx. I hope it is clear that we can do this procedure. Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I think I missed something somewhere along the line. How did we take the nth Wagner function out of the sum over n when it has an index n?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much. I have a time. Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. Good, good. Thank you. So now when we look at the result of acting this operator on phi star, and recall our Schrodinger equation that is written right there, then we will deduce that this is the integral of dx sum of n over n omega 1 n 1 x times this guy vx from here, minus nA, minus V of X, times phi star of X, E in power I K nA. So let's look closer at this expression that is very interesting and contains so many functions. So phi of x is picked, is non-zero around x equal to 0, right? So Wn is non-zero around, so let me write with somewhat smaller letters, but I hope you'll see. Non-zero around nA. This is non-zero around x equal to 0. Of course, when n equal to 0, this whole thing kills the whole contribution. So n cannot be equal to 0 in this sum. Right? Right. But this is picked around x equal to 0. This is picked around nA. So we already have small overlap. But let's look further. Here we have not Wn in the zero approximation, but in the first approximation. So this will mean that this whole term will have an additional order of smallness, second order of smallness, not the first order of smallness, but the second order of smallness. And we need to determine the correction up to the first order only. This is not a rigorous proof. This is just a heuristic consideration that allows us, in the required approximation, simply to equate the right-hand side to 0. So if we were to have here, say, omega n 0 x times phi star x, this has first order of smallness. Why? Because this is picked around n a, and this is picked around 0. But if we instead have here omega n already in the next order, then this guy, this whole guy will have higher order of smallness. Hence, approximately should be set in our calculations equal to zero. Just I will give you 10 seconds to realize what I have just said. This is what all condensed matter problems are about. Approximations, approximations, and approximations. Yes?
Sorry, I just don't seem to see where the last equality came from. So the one we are going to neglect, where it originally came from.
So sorry, say it once again.
Where the last equality on the board? So
this one.
Where does it come from?
It comes from that Schrödinger equation. So if we take this operator and act on phi star and compare with that equation, then we get here minus v of x.
So it's not the right hand side of the asterisk.
No. Let's not talk about the. We are still working only with the left hand side.
Okay.
So higher order of smallness compared to each term here. So
in the right hand side.
Yes, yes. So let's look. This guy has the zeroth order of smallness. So we have a Vanier function picked around an A. This has the first order of smallness. So this has the first order of smallness, right? And this has the first order of smallness because of Hn. Okay. But this guy has the higher order of smallness because we already have here this term and Vanier function already in the higher approximation. So this times this gives us second order of smallness.
Here, so you start from the left hand side equal to right hand side.
Yeah.
So this you have the same order of smallness.
Don't forget that we have done one more thing. We multiplied by phi and e and integrated.
But phi is a zero order of smallness.
Phi is the zero order of smallness, but as a result of manipulations, as a result of manipulations, we obtained this remarkable fact. So you see the point. If you have a function of x that has the zero order of smallness, and if you integrate it with something else, there is no guarantee that the final result will contain the same order of smallness, because integration is the procedure that is typically eliminates the information rather than.
So, I mean, the left hand side you do the integration, so for the right hand side you also do the
integration. Yeah, of course, this is what I will do now. Yes, of course, yeah. Of course, for the right hand side, I will do the integration, and this will give me the equations that will determine this epsilon in the first approximation. Yeah, this is what I'm going to do now.
Point is, say the left hand side, you do the integration and say it has a high order of smallness, and you simply put it zero.
Yeah.
But when you compare the left hand side after the integration, if you compare the left hand, the integration.
Well, okay, good. Of course, I set it equal to zero, then the energy spectrum is also determined from conditions that everything that stands in the right hand side should be put equal to zero. This is how people proceeded when they considered the calculation of energy level doing perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. Okay, let me continue, and we may talk about this later.
Thank you.
Yes.
Do you mean that when you do do the same to the right-hand side, multiply and integrate, you will get something that will not be of higher order of smallness. You will get something that will be...
Well, we assume that the left-hand side is equal to zero because it has a high order of smallness. So this correction in the first order should be also found from the fact that integrated with this function.
So when you do that integration, you will not get something on the right hand side. You will stay to your original.
Yes. Exactly. Yes, I will stay to my original order. So those calculations are valid only when we want to calculate the first corrections at the very, very approximate. So if you may find something similar if you look how people formulate perturbation theory for quantum mechanical operators with respect to the Schrödinger equation. So they treat one of the terms in the Hamiltonian as a perturbation and play with matrix elements. So only instead of matrix elements, we have just integrations over X. Anyway, Tian, we can discuss this later if you have questions. Okay, so I will continue. I will use this board because the information there is least relevant. So we do the following. We look at the right-hand side, multiply it by phi star of x, integrate, and get the following results. So right-hand side determines the correction. Epsilon 1 of k as follows. Epsilon k total equal to epsilon naught. Remember, we have here epsilon k minus epsilon naught. So plus the following sum over n h. So h as function of n. And remember, we had here, right, or somewhere above this h with index n. So when we integrate all the things over x, I will write down the explicit formula. So simply, we have here h of n times e power k n a divided by n I of n, e in power I k n a. So where we have the following, h of n equal to the integral phi star of x, h n of x. This is the original hn's. Phi x minus n a dx and I of n equal to simply phi star of x, phi x minus n a dx. So this is what we have. The sum over n means the summation over all sides. So what do we see from these expressions? We see that depending on the value of n, those parameters has again different orders of smallness. For example, when we put here n equal to 0, What are we going to have exactly? What is I of zero? Can anyone tell me?
One,
of course, one, because this is just the normalization condition for the wave functions of an electron moving around one given nucleus. One, absolutely, one. Then, for the other guys, we can only give an order of magnitude. So I, as a when n is equal to 1, then we're going to have here phi star of x and here phi of x minus a. But this phi is picked around 0, and this phi is picked around a. So overall, as a result of doing integration, assuming that things decay exponentially, we just have the order of magnitude phi of a that is exponentially small. Well, ideally, of course, exponentially. The faster the decay is, the closer we are to the tight binding approximation. So it should be exponentially small. So I of n is exponentially small can be compared to 1. Ideally, then because phi of 0 is of the order of 1. So it'll be meaning that we're around a nucleus. So then h of 0, let's look at h of 0. Here, this guy Hn has the order of magnitude of potential around 0. So, and let's write it this way, u of 0, or better said, u of 0, but v of 0, yeah. V of 0. So, I of course assume that the potential itself that does not blow up at zero, but tends to some finite value. So basically, we imagine that the potential created by a nucleus resembles some kind of a spherical well of a finite depth or so. Then h of 1 is equal to v of 0, phi of a, and again, much smaller compared to h at 0. So this just means that due to the fast decays of these guys, phi of a, so phi of 2a will decay, will be even smaller than phi of a, we can retain only some of the terms in this expression and limit ourselves to the terms to n either 0 or 1. So okay, let me erase what stands here. Okay, good. So when we do the corresponding expansion, we arrive at the following result, that epsilon of k equal to epsilon naught plus h of 0 plus 2 here h of 1 minus h of 0 I of 1. These terms have the same order of smallness. Right, times cosine ka. Or if we relabel the constant, this is by E0, and this guy, this whole guy in square bracket denote as t, we will get E0 plus 2t cosine ka. This is the main result that describes the energy spectrum. For, one second, for tight binding. This E0 is large, this T is small. So the, so with the capital letter 0 means that this epsilon naught is a little bit renormalized by H0. Okay.
And why is H of 0 like B of 0? I would think it's small. So H of 0, that's...
So H of 0...
So that goes like H subscript 0 around 0, right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, yes, we have phi squared times HN. One second. So HN of X is the potential, right? That.
Oh, so like the potential minus B, right? Around,
yes, yeah.
But then in around. So it would be small and the way I look.
Actually, yes, you are right. I missed something. Yes, it is V. Yeah, it is essentially too small. Yeah, it's not V of 0, I'm sorry. It's V of A. You're absolutely right. Because in Hn, the term with the country, if we set n equal to 0, then the term with the potential coming from zero side will be excluded. Yes, yes, you're right. Thank you. But H1 will be even smaller. This, yeah, thank you. I have a typo in my notes. Yeah, yeah. But the main conclusion of this derivation is that in this energy spectrum. T is much smaller than this E naught. Basically, the original energy level broadens into a band. So, okay, and during the remaining 10 minutes, I will just comment on one fact. I will write down the Hamiltonian for the electrons hopping between the sides of the lattice in one dimension that recovers exactly the same energy spectrum that I obtained by solving Schrödinger equation. So since Diane took 5-10 minutes, so then I will add also 5-10 minutes to my lecture. So I believe a good idea will be to erase this guy. Okay, guys, I understand that you're a little bit tired, but last 10 minutes, okay? So let's consider the whole Hamiltonian. Consider once again the one-dimensional chain, atom, or better to say it's side. This is A, so sides are located at R equal to NA. H equal to the following. Sum over all sides n, n spins, E0, Cn sigma dagger, Cn sigma plus T n sigma. Then here we have n Cn sigma Cn plus 1 comma sigma dagger plus C n plus 1 sigma dagger C n sigma. This is the Hamiltonian. These are the creation and annihilation operators that create or annihilate the particles at a given site. So remember, for the free electron gas, we introduced the creation and annihilation operators in momentum space, right? And they created and annihilated particles in a given state with momentum k. Here, they do the same, assuming that they create or annihilate the particles in coordinate space for given sites, not in momentum space. So if we do the following, if we introduce the Fourier expansions for these operators as follows: 1 over square root of n, sum over k, c k sigma dagger e in power minus a k n a, then c n sigma equal to 1 over square root of n, sum over k c k sigma e I k n a, and the inverse. But I won't write them to save time. Then if we plug these operators, so CK sigma dagger and CK, they create this time and annihilate particles in the state with quasi-momentum K this time. Yes?
What is the subscript on, so in the top line all the way on the right, so the final term? Yeah.
Cn plus 1. Yeah, n plus 1 comma sigma. Dagger, yeah, n plus 1. So this term is Hermitian conjugate to the first one. We have to add it because the Hamiltonian must be Hermitianly conjugate. So if we plug these operators, then we will get, so take this, guys, and plug. Here we will get that H can be written in the following form. H is equal to sum over k sigma c k sigma dagger c k sigma times epsilon k, where epsilon k has exactly the same form. A naught plus 2t cosine k a. So what people do nowadays, they assume those forms of starting Hamiltonians only, of course, not in one-dimensional lattices, but in two dimensions. So this Hamiltonian describes formally, I emphasize formally, free electrons. Of course, they're not free in reality, as I have just shown as the solution of the Schrodinger equation. But this Hamiltonian describes the electrons that hop freely between the sides of the lattice. They are not free, but they hop freely. And their spectrum is the tight binding spectrum of this form. So this result can be generalized easily for higher dimensions. So only instead of cosine kx, you will have the sum cosine kx a plus cosine ky a and possibly cosine kz a. But the point is that this is the basic starting point for the Hamiltonians in many, many condensed matter problems. Everything else that is responsible for such a big diversity of physical phenomena in two-dimensional condensed matter system includes interactions. And the simplest interaction, arises when we try to put electrons with opposite spins on one single site and get the so-called Hubbard model. But that's probably all for today. During today's tutorial, you will look at the band spectrum of graphene. to practice how to play with this Fourier expansions. And let me thank for your attention.